Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We meet around the kitchen table here once a week in downtown Ames at the studios of KHOI Community Radio. And we are glad you are with us today. I saw a few stray snowflakes.
I'm not surprised.
Oh, finally here.
Well, compared to was it only yesterday?
Only yesterday.
I heard, I don't know that this is true, but the boy at the grocery store who carried my groceries out said that he heard in Des Moines it was the warmest day in December ever recorded.
Wouldn't you know it? Well, it's cooling off, so it's time for Christmas lights, and you can tell this global warming thing. You can tell
it's over. The global warming's over. It's cold today.
No, but you can tell it. The global climate change is happening because seed catalogs are a whole month early.
I got one too. A gorgeous one.
Yeah, it is. Usually, I look for them after Christmas, but they're piling up. Well,
it's a sure sign, Lana. I mean, you know, commerce. Always, it moves more quickly than politicians and scientists, right?
We do. Well, this is the Donalana Kitchen. Thanks for joining us today. We get by with a little help from our friends.
Yes, the Donalana Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by Practical Farmers of Iowa, a member-based, farmer-led, nonprofit organization that has been strengthening farms and communities through farmer-led investigations and information sharing since 1985. You can find out more at their website, www.practicalfarmers.org.
Well, thanks to them, and thanks to you. This is Community Radio. We're all volunteers here, pretty much, and we talk about what we like to talk about. We talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. Yeah, we do.
Yes, we are a rather opinionated lot.
Well, somebody's got to be, yes.
That's right.
So, it is the Christmas season because I decorated my chicken house. That's the first thing you do for Christmas. So they've got their little wreath and their little lights are up. So I'm all kind of in the mood here. We like to talk about food. We like to taste food. And for the holiday season, and as we move into the new year, Donna and I will be exploring some of the many cuisines that Central Iowa has to offer. We're lucky to have so much to choose from. On future Donalana Kitchens, Donna and I will be visiting local eating establishments. It's hard work, but somebody's got to do it.
Yeah.
Lots of good things to talk about. And today we have a special guest.
Yes, we do. We are the focus of our visiting of local restaurants will be different immigrant communities that have moved to Iowa and come here and surprisingly enough, what do they want to share with us? Their food. Are we better off for that? You betcha we are. So today, for our first immigrant here, we have Marcus Johnson, a British immigrant who has the Mucky Duck. Welcome, Marcus.
Good morning, ladies. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, your establishment, and it is established at this point, it's a marvelous, lots of fun place with, I have to say, the best fish and chips in town.
Thank you.
And your bangers are fabulous. The mash isn't too bad. Are you still using real potatoes for your mash?
We actually use pre-made potatoes for the mash.
What's a pre-made potato?
It's very high quality. We get through so much mashed potato.
Oh, is it like a frozen potato?
No. It's mashed and then it's kind of a packet of mashed potato, but it's
real mashed potato.
It's real mashed potato. Yeah.
But the bangers. Tell us how you do the bangers.
What is a banger?
Right. We better.
What is a banger?
Step back. Yeah. Right. And why is it called that? Do you know?
Yes, I have answers to all those questions. Yeah.
Excellent.
Well, when we first opened, we used to let me tell you the little story behind this because there's a story here. We got bangers. I purchased them from California. And after a few years
and
of doing
they are
this,
made out of pork, right?
Oh, yes. They're pork, yeah.
So the pig probably was raised here, went to California, and probably came back again.
Yeah. Although you can get beef bangers, but we use the pork bangers. But anyway, I figured it was – this being Iowa, it didn't make a lot of sense to ship bangers halfway across the country to Iowa. And so I started looking into ways we could get them made locally and developed some relationships with some local meat lockers, and that have been very successful. So now our bangers come from Mike's Meats in Carroll. Mike does a fantastic job. There was a little bit of work involved. We had to
Did you arrive at the appropriate British seasonings?
Well, trial and error, mainly. Yes, I would like to.
Did you have to call your mom and say what was in these?
I tell people it was a recipe my grandmother scribbled down on a scrap of paper on her deathbed. You know, that was the last thing she did. She passed me this sacred recipe that she hadn't shared with anybody. but that's not quite true. We just trial and error came to the recipe because we've been making them for a long time, but when you scale things up.
Well, basically, a banger is a pork sausage.
And
what are the flavorings that make it a banger?
They're kind of similar to a breakfast sausage, but main ingredients are...
less sage.
Yeah, nutmeg, sage. There's a little bit of sage, mace, pepper, salt, those kinds of things. So they're very kind of a nice sort of savory flavor.
Well, they're really good. And I ate one last week, and it did not taste like a breakfast sausage. It tasted like a banger.
Right, yeah, yeah.
It's quite good.
Yeah. Well, there's bangers and there's bangers, actually. So,
it's like saying there's sausage and there's Italian sausage and there's Italian sausage.
Yeah, there's different varieties. And actually, that's another thing I want to talk about. In the UK, it's kind of almost like a cottage industry that's – many small producers that produce, very specifically.
Thank goodness.
Thank goodness. Yeah. And then there's sort of more generic varieties like the Cumberland sausage and things like that.
Is Cumberland like a large company or something?
That's a style.
It's
a style. It's an area and it's
okay.
It's a style.
So there are geographic designations.
Yeah.
And your particular one in your family is?
Well, it's more of a generic banger, right?
Other English people come in and don't want to feel alienated.
Yeah, some people ask very specifically for a particular type, and it's like kind of like tea. It's just a various different the different types of different mixes of the.
Lana, did you know that pork sausages are kind of like tea? That's very interesting.
Yeah.
Very good, Marcus.
Yeah. So that's.
Well, not only do you bring bangers to our community, but you started out before this wonderful pub developed with a thing called British Foods. Tell us about that adventure and how that turned into a pub.
Yeah, well, it's kind of a long story, but if you want, we've got an hour. So
it's a game story. Yeah. People have grown with your evolutionary explorations here, and you should tell us your thinking on the matter.
I've told this story 1,000 times, and it changes every time I tell it a little bit, but
it
gets embellished. But what happened was I used to work for the university, Iowa State, for Ames Lab. And
yeah, Marcus is an engineer.
Yeah, I'm a physicist, actually.
A physicist,
originally.
More specific. Right.
And we decided that we were going to – well, we decided we were going to go move to the Twin Cities. I took a job up there. My wife worked at Roosevelt at the time, and they decided to close Roosevelt, which we were sad about and kind of frustrated. And so we used that as the sort of
– bye-bye catalyst,
Okay. The decision process was if they close Roosevelt, then we're going to go. Turns out you should not be quite as flippant as that when you make decisions, but – we did it anyway. We were young. So we moved up to the Twin Cities. Didn't work out terribly well. My job wasn't what I expected. And so we stayed up there a couple of years and came back. And that's when my wife's a teacher, so she could get another position pretty easily. But I'm like, okay, what am I going to do now? And I got a little building that the place that everyone remembers there by the DOT on Lincoln Way there for some consultancy with my engineering business. And then I had some spare space, so I thought, let's put a little retail store here. I sell some British groceries, you know, digestive biscuits, tea.
Malt vinegar.
Bangers, malt vinegar, you know, solid cream, all the classics.
Things that you just couldn't find here.
Yeah. Mainly to feed my own need for those items, but yeah, if I sell some as well, that'll be a bonus. So that was, 10 years ago, probably now. And what happened was I found out that I quite enjoyed doing that side of things. And all these customers would come in and we would talk about travel and we'd talk about food and beer all day long. And that's kind of fun doing that as a living.
Oh, the food business. It's sort of like the entertainment industry.
It's like the entertainment industry. You get to talk to interesting people about interesting things all day long. It's really
fun.
Yeah. You know, we didn't make any money, or not much.
Well, but you were busy making money with the consultants,
well,
right?
Yeah.
Or were you too busy drinking tea with your
Too busy drinking tea and talking about food. It got to the point where I thought, okay, we've got to make money at this business. Otherwise, I have to...
Because I'm spending all my time
go and get a real job.
Too much fun, right?
Yeah. So we moved downtown right opposite you guys and had a lovely store there. I really... had it decked out nicely. We had great customers.
Right. This was in the Octagon space.
In the Octagon space, yeah. It's,
right?
it's a beautiful space.
Yes, and it is. Lots of light.
Right all
across
the windows.
The street from where we are sitting right now, more or less.
Yeah.
Downtown Ames. Okay.
And when you guys had a party, I could just wander over and
yeah,
I was
see,
there.
See,
and,
see.
Ursula used to have meetings over there with some of her clients and have a cup of tea. So it was a lovely space, and we had a lot more stock and a lot more customers. But it's still, you know, we ticked over, but it was not really a sort of sustainable business in terms of this is going to see me into retirement. So I knew we had to make some changes, and the option was get a real job or. You know, open a restaurant. People kept saying,
"Oh, well, the choices are obvious there, Marcus."
Yes, right. Yeah. The getting a real job was like, no, I can't do this. I'm not ready for that. I've been there, done it, and I didn't like it. at first I wanted to open a little cafe there, but it was going to be no kitchen space.
Right.
It was going to be very expensive to renovate it. Mm-hmm. So I just sat tight for a couple of years, and eventually an associate of mine purchased the gas station down on South Duff, the old Shars.
That's rather random, wasn't it?
It was random, yeah. And I kind of didn't think much of it at the time, but then I went down there a few times and noticed that, he was really interested in operating the restaurant side of it.
Right. Tell us what the restaurant side of it was initially.
Well, it was just a little sort of kind of like a gas station cafe. We call those greasy spoons in the UK.
Right, but this would be a greasy Dimitas spoon. Well, it was tiny.
Yeah, it was tiny and not very, welcoming.
Spick and span,
yeah. I'm on air, so I can't be too graphic, but it clearly could do a lot better. So
well, but you did open it up. You managed to pass your health inspections.
Yeah,
you turned it into.
Oh, we turned it into. Yeah. It was. We turned it into a nice little. A nice little gas station cafe.
Yeah.
And we called it the chip shop back then. But what happened was people would come in and they would say, well, I'd love to have a beer. You know, can I drink a beer? And I'm like, no, you can't. That's not legal. We don't have a license for that. So I got those comments frequently. There was a couple of other issues as well. The space was very small. The bathrooms were still gas station bathrooms and not very pleasant. So after, about a year or so of that, I said, can I take over the whole place and just turn it into a pub?
So you drove the gas station part out of business.
Well, what happened was actually the Casey's opened next door and built this shiny, glimmering new Casey's. And that really was the beginning of the demise of the original gas station. So
fortuitous for the Mucky Duck.
It was. Yeah, it was. People said I remember I bumped into some guy in the London Underground. And he said, that he'd been in the restaurant industry for 30 years, and that was the worst location he could think of, and we were going to be out of business in 6 months. And I'm like, this is a month before I'm supposed to open. I'm like, oh, well, I guess, you know.
Such encouragement. Yeah, that's part of the restaurant business. Yeah.
So obviously it made me feel kind of bad, but, you know, I wasn't going to change any of my plans
right,
at that point.
I suppose several people told you about the extremely high failure rate nationally.
Yes,
of restaurants.
Yes,
the usual.
Yes, yes, yeah. Yes. But I had a good feeling because we had the customer base. I'd spent, you know, 5 years in retail building a loyal customer base, people that were excited at the prospect of an English pub or British pub. So I had an inkling that it would be better than...
Plus, you were having way too much fun at this point.
I was having lots of fun, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's what's really nice. But Marcus, talk about what the difference is between a bar and a pub.
Well, we were just talking to a young lady out there, actually, who was from Wisconsin, and I think she knows the difference because bars in Wisconsin are kind of like pubs in the UK.
I mentioned that's the kind of place – I go into Marcus's place. It's the kind of place that I used to go with my dad in Wisconsin. It's got, like, families in it.
It's got families in it, yeah. It's very deliberately, you know, all ages, all demographics. We're absolutely not trying to focus on one particular section of the population. That's very important to me.
He sells lots of candy bars.
Candy bars, yeah. Yeah, draw the kids in with candy bars, yeah, and the adults. So, you know, it's just a wide open demographic. I have, you know, old people, especially at lunchtime. We get a lot of elderly people coming in, students, professional people, blue collar people, you name it. It's right across the spectrum, and that in essence is what the pub is, and that's what my local
comfortable.
Yeah, comfortable. That's the environment as well. But look at the White Horse in Grafham, where I'm from. You might see the wealthiest landowners, the ones that live on the, you know, £2 million farms, or you'd get the mechanic from the nearby petrol station, you know, that's earning, you know, very little money.
Because your food is really good and your beer and cider are even better.
Yeah, but it's more than just food. It's about the environment as well. And right. I think, you know, there's been this push over the last couple of decades to, you know, have restaurants that have cubicles that, you know, you can isolate yourself in a cubicle so you don't have to interact with anyone else. And people think they like that, but I think deep down we yearn for
more community. Out and pretend like you're still sitting at your dinner table at home?
Yeah, yeah. The point is to interact with people, to be part of the community, and it's very warming when I see that happening at the pub. And we have numerous examples of, like, on a busy night. There's no tables, but there'll be a four top table with two people sitting at it, and they will offer to a couple of people standing at the door. They'll say, "Would you like to join us?" This has happened frequently, and I watch their interactions. And within an hour or so, they're exchanging email addresses or phone numbers. They're buying each other drinks. And that's fantastic.
Good, the buying each other drinks. That's the point.
Yeah. Coffee or tea or whatever. And you know, that's such an alien concept to Americans, and actually even the British don't do that like the Europeans do. Yeah, if you go to Switzerland, it's common, but it's not very common even in the UK. The UK is oftentimes more similar to the US than people think. But it's certainly an alien concept to most Americans. So it's really, you know, warming to see that happening over here.
Well, but you do things at the restaurant to encourage it. Like, do you do game nights? And what do you do to encourage that?
Well, the game night actually is – the trivia night is is a very busy night. It's very chaotic. There's a lot of people that come on game night. I think the key is not so much on those events, but just hiring staff that are warm and welcoming, and, you know, take time to converse with the customers. I think that's, you know, and creating a sort of more open plan, close-knit.
And you do have a big bar, too.
It's big. It's not, it's not compared with, some establishments. It's not the biggest in town, but I think it's not forced, but people are kind of pushed together in a fairly compact environment, and that with I try to hire people that are not just good at their jobs, but have something interesting to say. They have personality,
right.
Yeah,
right.
And they can have a conversation with our customers. That's very, very important.
Yeah. I can't remember the author of the book, but there's a book called The Great Good Place, and it's a study about bars, pubs, cafes, places that people go that's not their home, that's not their work, but it is a place where you do part of your living because it's kind of an extension of your living room.
Social, very social.
It's a social place. What am I saying about walking into the Mucky Duck? What a great name, the Mucky Duck. You walk into the Mucky Duck, and above the bar are all of these mugs with people's names on it. So you figure that somebody's been here before you. It must be a good place because there's all these mugs up there that are already claimed. And matter of fact, the Mucky Duck has really good beer. We're going to come take a little break here and come back. And I want to ask Marcus about all that good beer he's got out there. This is KHOI. This is the Donalana Kitchen Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Welcome back. This is the Donalana Kitchen. We are around our kitchen table with Marcus Johnson. He has a wonderful establishment called the Mucky Duck. We are lucky to have him in central Iowa, the Mucky Duck. It's a pub. Talk about beer, Marcus. Why beer and why is it so good at your place?
There's cider there, too. I had a very good glass of cider.
Yeah, cider and beer. Yep, they make the world go round. And we have always, right from the beginning, wanted to focus on the unusual, the hard to get,
the delicious, from
small local establishments. We have imported beer from the UK, and we have beer from some of the big manufacturers as well. But a big part of our product line is locally produced. And I know you were interested in asking me about cask beer.
Yes, you're the first place I'd ever heard of this. Explain what that is.
So, cask beer is common quite common in the UK, especially in the smaller local establishments. Basically, the fermentation process, it's a two kind of stage process fermenting. Anyone that's familiar with homebrew will be familiar with the concept of putting the priming sugar into the bottle, and then if you're unlucky, those bottles explode in your airing cupboard and you've got a huge mess. Well, cask beer is kind of a similar idea.
Do they explode?
But they self-pressurize. So the beer is put in this not quite finished beer is put into the cask, which looks a bit like a keg. They have interesting names like firkin and pin and things like that. They're old English terms. But the priming sugar is added, and there's a little bit more fermentation that occurs. And if you get that wrong and put too much sugar in, then you've got a big mess. This is common in the UK. These casks are live. They're unpasteurized, so there's sediment and yeast in there. They have to be handled in a very specific way. Once they're tapped, then they have only about a week of shelf life. Then you have to throw them away. And that can be a problem. There's certainly many, many times I've been into a country pub in the middle of nowhere and had a pint of vinegar, and that can certainly happen, and that's the price you pay for having a very natural, very organic product. And that's one of the reasons why that is not common over here, is we have a larger scale.
A little risky.
It's risky. You've got a large-scale distribution problem.
Financially risky.
Financially risky,
right.
Yeah. But we think it's worth the risk, and we have worked with a number of local breweries. Mainly, the one that really got us started was Broad Street out of Rhinebeck, which is a little German town just, northeast of here, a little ways. And they have a very kind of organic business model. They purchased their brewing system from a closed-down brewery in London and shipped it all over. It's really a cute little small-scale system, but very,
okay,
very...
I can't even imagine how you tracked them down and found this out, but...
Yeah, Google.
very
modern. So they were a primary source of casks for us for a long time, but we've expanded things a little bit. Now we also get them from Confluence and Exile, and I think even Peachtree, and then occasionally one of the bigger breweries such as Summit. Provided one.
So these beers are available to one at a time. It's kind of your featured thing, or do you have many of them?
We do.
How do they arrive? Certainly not on UPS.
No, they arrive on a truck. of course, in the old days, it would be a dray, a horse-drawn dray. But there are still breweries in the UK that do that. In fact, actually, Budweiser, I think, still has one.
One of those horses,
yeah,
okay.
One of those horses, but yeah, dray. They arrive. We tap them every Thursday night. One every Thursday night, and sometimes it's.
What's the volume in a cask?
Well,
sort of.
A firkin, which is the standard largest size, is about 60 to 70 pints, and
okay.
Then a pin, which is about half that size, is about 30 odd pints. Once we tap that, I keep it on the bar, basically a
stable position.
In a stable position, yeah. Slightly tilted, and that is iced, and we keep it iced usually until Monday if it hasn't sold. Sometimes they sell the same night, but the larger ones we can usually keep that till Monday. And there are a few other places that do them occasionally. I think the El Bait Shop, which is very very well known bar in Des Moines for beer. They will occasionally do a cask, but there are not many places that do them.
Another singular attraction to Ames. Thank you,
good,
Mark.
Good beer at the Mucky Duck.
Let me just add, tapping them is entertaining because this is a pressurized, it's self-pressurized.
Is it like getting the cap off the cork out of the
champagne?
Well,
you have to basically knock a spile. It's called a spile. It's a little wooden plug. You have to knock that in to the top. As it's laying down. And if it's not pressurized quite right, then you can sometimes get a big fountain of beer. So we always have a lot of fun, especially when my colleague Anne-Marie, she got covered in beer once, and it was became this little fun tradition. Thursday at 4 o'clock.
So what time do you do this?
It's 4 o'clock on
Thursdays.
4 o'clock
on Thursdays. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Put that in the calendar.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Drama, and it just sounds really good. Cask night at the Mucky Duck.
And what mention just a bit about ciders. What do you have?
Well, yeah, ciders are really interesting. I think
you have some draft ones, right?
The only one we have on tap is the Magners, which is a fairly common cider. It's an Irish cider. We used to serve the English Strongbow, but they changed the recipe a little bit. I think they were trying to compete more with the American market, so they sweetened it up a little bit, and
put us off.
So now we serve the Irish cider Magners, which is a fantastic cider.
It is. I had one the other day. Yep, I'm a big drinker of cider from actually Brittany. So don't want it very sweet.
Have you ever had the K cider?
I have no idea.
It came in a dark bottle with a red lettering on it. It was a fantastic, very dry, very strong cider from that part of that part of the country. Yeah, yeah.
They have a lot of good ones over there.
Yeah, they do, yeah.
Hundreds, thousands probably. Yeah. So. Mm-hmm.
Well, we've picked up some of the local ones. Deals, obviously, make a really nice cider. Mm-hmm. There's that new one in Iowa City area. The name eludes me temporarily. We try to pick up some local ones. And there's, quite a few from the Twin Cities area.
And more and more, thank goodness.
Yeah. I think it's when I first moved to the U.S. 20 years ago, it was a very tiny fraction of the market.
Oh, right. People, you say cider, they think of fresh.
They think of
cider, sweet.
Yeah.
But it's a very old tradition. And if you've ever found an apple tree someplace off in the odd part of the country and you taste it and go, oh, this is the worst apple I have ever had. Those are cider apples.
Right.
they are not meant to be sweet.
Yep.
And
yep.
They make delicious beverage.
Yep. Yep.
So I will be out again and try some more.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
Sounds good. Well, we have the holidays coming up, and I believe the British do a few fun things for the holidays.
Oh, yes.
Let's talk British holidays. How do you like to celebrate? What's going on, Marcus?
It's very interesting. I mean, the Brits are not a terribly religious group of people. Right. But
they like to party.
But we love Christmas.
Oh.
And in particular, we like food and in many cases, drink at Christmas time as well. Christmas is huge. And what I've found is with the British store, that's when our business really booms, is because people – expats really crave their traditional British
things from their childhood.
Things from their childhood, yeah, yeah, and even people that have been over here for many decades,
Christmas turns us all into children.
It does,
it's a wonderful thing,
and there's nothing wrong with that.
No,
yeah.
So, and I believe you have Christmas dinners.
Yep, yep. The family Christmas dinner is, of course, one of the most important parts of the general Christmas celebration for the British.
And are you having one tonight?
We are having one tonight. We have
two. You have two dates, right?
We have four dates,
they're
pretty much mostly sold out, I think, unfortunately. Mm-hmm.
Good for you.
Yep, yep. We have.
Oh, tell us about what's on the table for that.
Yeah, what's the menu?
Well, it's Christmas. The traditional English Christmas or British Christmas is turkey. So it's not terribly different to
it's not goose.
No, well, some people have goose. Yeah, yeah. But my family.
Christmas is coming. The goose is getting fat.
Yes, that one.
The turkey's getting fat. Okay.
I have to be a little careful because I oftentimes speak, in terms of my experiences growing up and.
Your childhood.
My family might not have been normal. In fact, I know they weren't normal. But it's funny, my colleague Anne-Marie that I talk about often, she's from Oxfordshire, and it was fun to compare sort of traditions. And oftentimes my perception of I do comparisons between, American culture and British culture, and I'll look at, we did this, when I was growing up.
Say that, and it's not what we're doing now, right?
Well, I extrapolate that to everybody, and then I'll speak to Anne-Marie, and she'll say, "Well, we didn't do that. We didn't serve, Yorkshire puddings with Christmas dinner. That's ridiculous. I'm like, oh, well, maybe maybe other people did different things.
Yeah.
So when I'm talking to you now, it's from, you know, my experience, which it's like the little fine print at the bottom. This does not necessarily represent the broader population of the UK. Just FYI. So we always had turkey, and we'd have many vegetables with that, you know, Brussels sprouts and roast parsnips. And one of my favorites, which I always include on the Christmas dinner that we serve at the pub, and in my opinion, one of the most underrated root vegetables, is the rutabaga.
Yes!
Yes, which we call the Swede England.
That's
but creamed rutabaga, if you've never had it before, it's fantastic. I often
which
take...
Which means lots of butter.
Lots of butter, yeah, a little bit of pepper, a little, maybe some sugar if you need to, just to taste. But you can take it to your next party, and people will be saying, "What is this? What did you do to this mashed potato?" And then you tell them, "Well, actually, it's rutabaga," and they'll look at you with this most amazing look because they've probably never even picked one up before.
I think they're wonderful myself. That's good.
It's true, and we do have an American history of it. For example, Carl Sandburg, our noted Illinois poet and writer, wrote the Rutabaga Stories, which are two different books of children's stories.
Hmm.
And then there's the Frank Zappa song, Rutabaga, Rutabaga.
Well,
remember
see,
that one?
See, okay. No, right. But that was a lovely rendition, Donna. It was good.
I love rutabaga. Okay.
So is plum pudding actually a very traditional thing, or is that just something we are rediscovering? Donna talks about plum pudding. I never made that.
Yeah, well, first of all, it doesn't have plums in it. That's
the
number one misconception.
Yes, that was a shocking thing to when I learned that.
Yeah. But it's otherwise known as Christmas pudding, and it's served at the Christmas as a dessert at the Christmas dinner table. It has lots of unusual things, sultanas and
that would be raisins,
peels, and
citrus peels,
and things like that. And people that are making it properly will make this pudding in October, and then
pudding is a cake.
Yeah, pudding is one of those weird words. It has multiple meanings in the British English dictionary.
Translate, Marcus. For us.
Well, pudding, you know, can mean a general dessert. It can just mean you might say to your kids, "Do you want some pudding?" And that would mean dessert.
Sweet, yeah.
Sweet dessert afterwards. Or it can mean a suet-based savory type of dish. So, for example, steak and kidney pie, but you can have which is made with pie crust, but you can have steak and kidney pudding, which is more of a suet a crust. So that's pudding.
And not sweet,
no, mm-hmm. no. And then, of course, Christmas pudding, also suet-based, but completely different to a steak and kidney pudding.
Well, not to take it all away from the English, but on our Donna Lana website recipe page, which you can find on the internet, I have a recipe listed for Grandma Baumgartner's Christmas pudding? No.
Just plum pudding.
Christmas pudding? No. Something. Anyway, it's my grandmother's German version, which is very – I mean, the Germans and the English were kind of all in on this.
Oh,
one.
Yeah. Glühwein, mulled wine, you know.
Yeah,
same kind of thing.
Right.
Yep.
Merry old England and wonderful German Christmas are very, very similar.
And then does one traditionally set it on fire?
Yes.
Oh, that's the best part.
You feed it. If you're making it traditionally, you feed it brandy. Over the period between October and Christmas.
Oh, it's an that. Oh, so yours is aged.
Aged,
okay.
Yeah. But you don't have to do that, and we don't do that at the pub. But then you can traditionally pour brandy over it
and set it on fire.
Turn the lights out, set it on fire, bring it out to the table. Remember to take the sprig of holly out before lighting it. Otherwise, you've got a little bonfire on your hands.
See, safety first.
So a steamed pudding, and you'll see from the recipe that I have for my grandmother. It's kind of like almost like a cooked fruit cake, right?
That
you cook. Like, here's how I do it. I take a big pot. Yeah. I put some sort of rack in the bottom. And then I actually take a, what are those cake pans that are?
Bundt?
A Bundt pan. I take a Bundt pan and put the pudding in there, cover it with foil, set it on the rack, put the water in the pan, and put a lid on the pan.
Yeah.
So you make a steamer that way.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. And, we use we actually use a roaster oven at the pub.
Oh, good idea.
And,
Very good idea.
The only reason we don't use a Bundt pan is because we don't want that hole in the middle.
Well, yeah, and you're trying to make a quantity of them.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But we just use a ceramic bowl.
Oh, yeah, that's very English.
Yeah.
Now, what is the hard sauce that you put on them?
Well, it's either brandy or rum. The one we've got made right now is a rum-based hard sauce.
So, like vanilla, sugar, butter?
Butter, yep.
Rum?
I don't remember the exact recipe.
Something like that. Yep. I do put lemon in mine just because I lived in California for too long.
Yep.
But the hot sauce is sometimes, let's just say if you eat the pudding without the hot sauce.
Hard sauce.
Hard sauce, right. Sorry. If you eat the pudding without the hard sauce, you may say you don't like the pudding. But with the hard sauce, it's really good.
Yeah.
Very good.
You can use, heavy whipping cream as well.
Yes.
That would be fine.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's beginning to seem a little bit like Christmas around here. This is good. You're listening to KHOI. This is the Donalana Kitchen. Find out more about this fine show and this radio station at khoifm.org. A little Christmas music here. This is from the best of the Baltimore consort. This is called Christmas Day in the Morning, a traditional tune from the Shetland Islands, which is probably a long way from where you grew up, but a little closer to you
than
Iowa. So anyway, Christmas Day in the Morning. Welcome back. This is the Donalana Kitchen. We're talking to Marcus Johnson. We're talking about English traditions and, of course, food. What have you brought for us today, Marcus?
Well, it's Christmas now.
Well,
we're ready.
It's getting there.
Yeah. So these things are Christmas crackers, which Americans oftentimes call them poppers if they're familiar with them. And these are set at the dinner table, usually in the position where the spoon would be. And so you kind of pull them with your neighbor or partner. Let's do one in here. And it has a little firecracker in there. I don't know if you heard that, but it goes pop. Inside, there is a joke, a paper hat.
Oh,
and
yes, the paper hat.
Some kind of trinket of some sort.
Here's my joke. Why do bakers work so hard? Because they need the dough.
There.
See? Now, this is something you cannot fault the British for doing this, because you're around the table, you're opening up these wonderful little crackers, which are actually more, like you say, more like a popper.
Okay. The trinket is a little, should we call it a donkey or a...
Some little plasticky animal.
Yeah. And Marcus has the green crown
on, and
everyone
has the good graces to put on these absolutely silly, paper hats.
You have to put on the hat. And I just have a memory of my grandmother, who was not a very happy lady. And she would sit around the dinner table, and she would put the hat on, but she had her arms folded, and she had a miserable and cynical expression on her face. But she was wearing the hat. So...
We always worry
coerced
about getting...
Coerced by tradition.
Coerced by tradition, yeah.
We worry about getting together with our loved ones, which end up kind of maybe kind of tense sometimes, but somehow this tradition of breaking open these jokes...
I think that's true. I think
it's good.
If you anticipate having a difficult Christmas party, you better rush over to the Mucky Duck and get a set of crackers to have at the dinner table. It's a marvelous diversion. You don't have to talk about politics, sex, or religion. You can do crackers.
Well, my wife's family have adopted these now, so we always have them around the dinner table when we go home to her house. So.
Oh, very good.
And your wife is American.
Yes, she's from Southwest Iowa. Uh-huh. So it's not a hard tradition to get into. It's kind of like me and Thanksgiving. You know, it's no.
Yeah,
if it's around a table, we can do that.
We can do that. Yeah.
Good. Good.
I also have another really common thing you'll see in the household at Christmas is the Turkish Delight. Of course, most Americans are familiar with this from the C.S. Lewis books, and they've heard of it, but they don't exactly know what it is.
Right. It sounds so exotic and wonderful. What exactly is a Turkish Delight?
Well, it has pistachios in it, for sure.
And that's a variant. Most of the standard ones don't normally have those. But
what do they have in them usually?
It's just plain sugar.
Right?
It's basically sugar. It's
sugar and gummy.
Yeah, it's so soft. It's a chewy, soft jelly-like substance, and it's very sweet.
My
precursors
kind of
gummies, I guess, basically.
All these things I'm going to leave here, so you can have fun with them.
All right, we have to try
later.
A Turkish
Delight.
Let's
have a Turkish Delight.
Good.
Oh!
See?
They're covered in powdered sugar.
Yeah, it's covered in powdered sugar, just to add a little bit more sugar there.
No, they're good.
It's slightly more chewy than a marshmallow. But about the same.
Right,
With the pistachio in it. Here, Evan and Lana. Now we'll all talk funny on the radio cover. Chewing on our Turkish Delight. They actually taste good.
Yeah. Sweet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Not as bad as a marshmallow, though.
No, I've never got used to marshmallows.
No. Have you ever tried to make Rice Krispie treats out of Turkish Delights?
No.
Well, could be an experiment.
Yeah.
This is something that is usually purchased from a candy maker, or do people make Turkish Delight at home?
Typically not. They'll just buy from the store. Yep.
And it's only at Christmas?
Yeah, pretty much.
Oh, good.
Yep, pretty much. Yep.
Good.
Yep. We have the ubiquitous box of chocolates. There's a couple of major brands. Quality Street is one of the more common. They're just a mixed assorted chocolates. Every household in the UK will have either a box of these or a box of the other brand, which is Roses. It's one of those things.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Here's a Christmas pudding, just so you can see what that looks like.
So the prepackaged pudding, basically, you still have to put it in the steamer and heat it up?
Yeah, you can heat it up in the steamer.
Microwave, I suppose.
You could microwave it. You could actually microwave it.
Yes, the luxury Christmas pudding. But then you would still have to make the hard sauce.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Or you could buy it in a jar.
Oh, you have hard sauce at the store. Of course you do. What am I thinking?
Yep.
Good. Everything for the English
make
Christmas.
Make life easy, yeah.
Good. Good.
And just various packs. Candy. Candy is big.
More candy.
At Christmas,
yes. This one has Maltesers, Mars Bars, Twixt, and Snickers. That's a Snickers and Milky Way are British, too?
Yes. Yeah.
Well,
so so the candy is big. Well, we don't have very long, so one thing I wanted to mention is that we were talking earlier about timing, and this is all done. The actual Christmas bit itself, mm-hmm. the opening of presents, etc.,
is
done.
When does Santa come?
He comes at night, and unlike you guys who leave out milk and cookies, we don't. We leave out brandy and something else.
I bet you get better presents that way.
Yeah, you get better presents when you leave out brandy.
After all, it's the reindeer who's driving.
I think in my family, they even left out a can of Guinness.
That's
which
good.
Just by coincidence happened to be one of my dad's favorite drinks. Oh. But,
well, yeah. He knows best about Santa, doesn't he?
Yes, he knows. My dad knew about Santa, yeah.
So then the celebration is in the... The kids come running downstairs in the morning.
Yep.
The presents are there.
Yep.
The Guinness is gone.
Yep.
And then when do you have the dinner? Like
the dinner is at lunchtime.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And a tradition in many households is to go down the pub after you've opened your presents and you can show off your beautiful new Argyle sweater and have everyone laugh at you. And then you come back
for lunch
half an hour later than you were supposed to. And get into a little bit of trouble, and then you have the lunch, and then you
obviously
watch.
The mom is at home.
The mom is at home
cooking,
which you know is terribly unfair.
Right, but however, if dad takes all the kids to the pub with him, that's not so unfair.
That's not so unfair.
No.
Yep. And then critically, I haven't lived over there for 20 years, so I don't know if this is still true, but Americans find this very bizarre. We then watch a movie or two in the afternoon, and without question, the Wizard of Oz will always be on Christmas Day.
Really?
And that's I told my wife
on
that.
On television.
And that's everybody will watch the Wizard of Oz without exception. That is as Christmas as it gets in the UK. And I don't know
I like
exactly
that.
Where that came from.
I like but, that. Well, because it's a cheery.
It's a cheery, yeah, yeah.
Yet, of course, those monkeys in there are. What a good choice, yes.
Yeah. So you'll sit in front of the open fire.
Multi-generational.
Watching.
Good. So. Oh, cute.
And then you have Boxing Day the next day. Did you
still do that? Explain to me one more time. I do not understand Boxing Day.
Well, it's just another excuse to have a day off without going back to work. But originally it comes from the thought for the poor. And so at church they would pass a box around.
Oh.
In the sanctuary, and people would put some money or gifts into the box, and that would go to the poor people.
All right. Yep. In my imagination, it was like everybody putting all of their Christmas presents, which they hated, back into the boxes and be exchanged.
Yeah.
But that's a much nicer explanation, Mark.
Yeah. One other little unusual thing is the English and the Brits love to go for a walk, so you'll see a lot of people out walking on Christmas Day.
Is that before or after the movie?
Either way, but after opening
after
the presents.
After lunch.
After lunch for sure.
Okay.
Yep.
Sounds like a wonderful way to spend a holiday. Yeah. Christmas crackers and pudding and walking and the Wizard of Oz. Yes. Thanks to Marcus Johnson of the Mucky Duck for sharing some holiday sort of ideas.
And for sharing your English traditions year-round at the Mucky Duck. We appreciate that.
Thank you.
Yes. There are some upcoming things going on here in Ames. This coming weekend, you can find the Alternative Gift Market at Wheatsfield Grocery. Find out some worthwhile places to put your Christmas spending. And here, Tuba Christmas coming this Saturday.
Boy.
Now, what could be better than Tuba Christmas? A bunch of tubas playing Christmas carols.
I mean, a lot of tubas.
But now, there's not one but two performances of Tuba Christmas at 1:30 p.m. Saturday, December 9th, and at... At 11, and then at 1:30.
Right.
So there's two.
At the First Methodist Church downtown.
So,
and the acoustics are quite good for this sort of thing. It's pretty cool.
It's pretty cool.
I will be there.
And what's better than two tuba Christmases? This is new this year, too. A lunch in between. So there'll be Christmas cookies in between. So that's a good tradition.
Right.
That's a good tradition.
The First Methodist Church downtown. What street is it on? It's across the street from the post office.
Close enough.
Can't miss it.
Yeah. It's Kellogg. Yeah. Okay. So you've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. Thanks to our special guest, Marcus Johnson from the Mucky Duck. And thanks to you, our listeners, for your attention, for your feedback, for your support.
And start that ho, ho, ho feeling.
Yeah.
We got the weather finally.
Support this radio station. Go to khoifm.org. Donate, listen anytime to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're streamed. We're on there. We have archives. Music today by fiddler Liz Carroll and the Baltimore Consort. My name's Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had excellent engineering by Evan Taylor. Eat good food and enjoy life.